From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Kurds rise up in Europe as Kurdish independence leader Öcalan awaits trial in an undisclosed location in Turkey. Three Kurdish protesters are killed by security guards at the Israeli embassy in Germany. Also, a debate on truth and media misinformation in Kosovo. And as the U.S. closes a sad chapter on Japanese internment camps, a conversation with political novelist Marnie Mueller. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Two women scaled flagpoles outside Chevron's world headquarters in San Francisco yesterday and unfurled a banner that said, "Do people kill for oil? People do." This was part of a day of protests against the oil transnational giant that were held in California, Lagos, and the Niger Delta. Demonstrators charged that Chevron has blood on its hands after reports confirmed once again that the oil company had flown the Nigerian military into communities along the Niger Delta, this time this past January 4th, and that a number of villagers were killed and injured as a result. The two women in San Francisco, Genevieve Raymond and Shannon Wright of the Rainforest Action Network, were subsequently arrested by police. While Shannon Wright was perched atop the flagpole, she spoke with Democracy Now! On a cellular phone.
This is Shannon Wright from Rainforest Action Network. I'm here with Project Underground as well, and we are about 35 feet up the flagpole at Chevron's world headquarters, deploying a banner that reads, "Does do people kill for oil? People do." We are denouncing Chevron's complicity and participation in killings in Nigeria. There's been a series of killings of villagers in Nigeria who are trying to defend their rights and have a clean environment. They have asked that the oil companies operate in a respectful and clean way or they must leave. Chevron has all but admitted that their helicopters and boats have been used to actually transport the Nigerian military who have then taken raided different communities. So we are here at Chevron's headquarters asking that Kenneth Durr, the CEO, come forward and take the step in the right direction by suspending operations in Nigeria until a peaceful and meaningful dialogue takes place with the communities and their concerns are directly addressed.
That was Shannon Wright. In fact, yesterday was her birthday. After the protest, four people were arrested, were held overnight. And they did get part of what they wanted. Chevron has finally agreed to a dialogue with community activists. Also, the latest news from Washington, D.C., Ohio Democrat Dennis Kucinich is calling for a congressional investigation into Chevron and other oil giants' participation in killings and violence in the Niger Delta. And the Securities Exchange Commission is still considering whether to allow a shareholder resolution introduced by some shareholders against Chevron as a result of their activities in Nigeria. The Pentagon is sending 51 U.S. warplanes to keep up the pressure on Serb leaders to approve a peace plan for Kosovo. NATO has threatened airstrikes if a deal isn't reached by this weekend. Speaking this morning upon his arrival in Seattle, Defense Chief William Cohen said the U.S. wants to at least prepare for taking action. Today's Washington Post reports that photos obtained by states for driver's licenses may be then sold to a New Hampshire company. The firm, Image Data, supposedly wants to build a database of license photos to help fight crimes like credit card and check fraud. But the paper says Image Data didn't disclose that it got nearly $1.5 million from Congress as well as technical help from the Secret Service. According to the Washington Post report, officials in Washington apparently saw potential for battling terrorism and other crimes, but Florida and Colorado quickly canceled photo sales after a rash of complaints. This news from London, seven environmental protesters were arrested today after dumping 4 tons of genetically modified U.S. soybeans outside British Prime Minister Tony Blair's official residence. Greenpeace UK director Peter Melchett said this is one of the few households in the United Kingdom where the occupier seems to want to eat the stuff. He said this as police moved the protesters' truck decorated with the slogan, "Tony, don't swallow Bill's seed." The giant sacks of beans block the entrance to Downing Street and the official residence of Blair, who has spoken out enthusiastically in favor of genetically modified foods and says he eats them himself. The government has found itself embroiled in a national panic over the possible risks to human health and the environment from GM products. Newspapers have dubbed them Frankenstein foods, and supermarkets have been trying to reassure their customers. And this news from Indianapolis, German pharmaceutical giant Bayer AG participated in World War II atrocities committed by Nazi doctors who experimented on Jews. This according to a federal lawsuit filed by a Holocaust survivor. Bayer paid Nazi officials for access to those confined in concentration camps and collaborated in Nazi experiments as a form of research and development. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Kurds are all over Europe holding protests for a third day to denounce the arrest of PPK leader Abdullah Öcalan in Kenya this Monday, as well as the killing yesterday of 3 Kurds by Israeli security guards at the Israeli consulate in Berlin. The 3 were killed and at least 16 injured when they were protesting the possible involvement of the Israeli Foreign Intelligence Service, known as the Mossad, and Öcalan's arrest. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu denied the Mossad's involvement in Öcalan's arrest and said the guards killed the protesters in self-defense. Öcalan's lawyers today accused the CIA of taking part in Öcalan's capture, a charge the U.S. has denied. Meanwhile, dozens of protests are taking place at Greek and Israeli missions all over Europe, and up to 70 Kurdish activists have taken over the UN headquarters in Vienna. Öcalan's arrest has turned into a huge international controversy. Greek Foreign Minister Theodore Pangalos and 2 other cabinet members resigned yesterday amid the political fallout after Greece failed to protect Öcalan from arrest by Turkish authorities. Öcalan had taken refuge in the Greek embassy in Nairobi when he was captured and flown back to Turkey. The Kenyan government also reshuffled its cabinet today, although there's no immediate confirmation whether it's tied to Öcalan's capture. Some officials have been shifted and others fired, and there are reports that the chief of immigration, Frank Quinga, may have lost his job after reports that Öcalan was able to sneak into the country using a false passport. The Kurdish independence leader is being transferred to an island prison in Turkey after several hundred prisoners were evacuated from the detention facility. He's awaiting trial and faces the death penalty if convicted. Öcalan's lawyers, who've been denied entry into Turkey, have said they fear for his life, and international human rights organizations have questioned whether he will receive a fair trial in Turkey. Turkish authorities have thus far said international observers will not be permitted to witness Öcalan's trial. We're joined right now by 2 people to talk about the latest news on Öcalan. Vera Bodin Saidpour is with us, founder of the Kurdish Library and Kurdish Museum in New York. She's editor of Kurdish Life and International Journal of Kurdish Studies. Holly Kartner is also with us, Executive Director of Human Rights Watch for Europe and Central Asia. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Vera Saidpour, can you talk about these latest developments and what you think the significance of Öcalan is for the Kurds?
Well, in terms of the significance of Ocalan, he really represents the only group that has had the wherewithal to mount an armed conflict in response to a 73-year-old policy of denying and punishing any manifestation of Kurdish ethnic existence. And so whereas there are other Kurdish groups in Turkey, no group has put its life on the line in that way, in that overt way. And so he really symbolizes for the Kurds those who will die for them to get their rights. In terms of the Kurdish situation now, that was really precipitated by a move by Turkey to get Ocalan evicted from Syria. And when he got into Europe, he expected better treatment because he expected that all of the European countries that had rhetorically promoted Kurdish rights, based largely on the fact that they didn't want to admit Turkey into the EU and the Kurds were a perfect hook in terms of their human rights record, apparently they didn't want to put their money where their mouth was, you know, when it was really difficult for them, so that they managed to get rid of him, and now rhetorically they're asking for a fair trial for him. But I think that this is only the eye of the storm, because from now on it just really depends on what happens with him as to what's going to happen in terms of Kurdish response.
Holly Kortner, what is your assessment of Ocalan, your understanding of how he actually did get to Turkey and what his significance is?
Well, on the issue of his significance, I think that it's absolutely right that he has been the leader of a movement that really put Kurdish rights, or the violation of Kurdish rights in Turkey, on the map, and he did this through an armed conflict that has been going on for some 15 years now. I guess one point that I would like to make as a human rights organization, there is no doubt that the Turkish government has violated Kurdish rights in every respect and continues to do so quite brutally today. There are a number of different ways that we could discuss this in terms of the torture, the attacks by Turkish armed forces on Kurdish villages in the southeast. There are a whole host of abuses that the Turkish army has committed. However, I think it's quite different to talk about the struggle for Kurdish rights and to look at Ocalan and the trial process that is now underway. We have taken the position from the beginning of his arrest in Italy that he should be brought to trial, because every side in a conflict needs to be held accountable for its abuses, and the PKK has unfortunately committed its fair share of atrocities during the conflict. So we believe that it is necessary for justice to take place for Ocalan to be held accountable. However, we were opposed to him being extradited to Turkey because we had serious concerns about his ability to obtain a fair trial there, as well as his own physical security in Turkey. He is a security detainee. He will be prosecuted under the state security courts in Turkey, and as such, he will be given a more limited number of procedural protections than a normal criminal defendant would get. Security detainees in Turkey generally are much more vulnerable to torture and other mistreatment. So those are concerns that we have had about the fact that he is now in custody in Turkey.
Vera Saidpour, what is your response to Human Rights Watch assessment of Abdullah Ocalan?
Well, I just find it always interesting that in order to be even-handed, the human rights organizations talk about the responsibility of guerrillas, but I feel this way. I feel that there has been in modern times, no more chronic, no more egregious situation for Kurds in the world. There's no comparison between the Kurdish situation in Turkey, to have been summarily ethnically cleansed by decree, and then to have any manifestation of your culture, whether it be a headdress or a music tape or a piece of paper written in Kurdish or a Kurdish speech in public. compared with, say, the Iraqi Kurds, who really were fighting for control over their land without this cultural kind of annihilation that took place and has continued to take place in Turkey. So that I feel that to put people in such a desperate situation to have a supporter no less than the United States to excuse and to dismiss what has been happening while they've been attending to places like Bosnia and Kosovo, I think you have people in an untenable position with no ombudsman really anywhere, because to talk about the human rights abuses is not really to ameliorate them. It's simply to expose them. But there's such a litany of abuses there that it really defies the imagination of any American. And I think that the desperation of the Kurds, which you can see from the protests in Europe, the desperation to have no place in the world really to turn to, nothing. If you back up a rat into a corner, he will attack you. And I think in terms of the violence that went on in the conflict, the Kurds have had very good teachers growing up in Turkey. So that I think that when you talk about war, you talk about violence, and that's inherent in the situation. And I just feel that you're talking about desperate people who really have a justifiable, the most justifiable of all the Kurdish situations, really, to have reacted in the way that they have.
Holly Kartner, your response to Vera Sayedkor?
Well, for most of what Vera has said, I absolutely agree. I mean, there is no doubt that the Kurdish people in Turkey have suffered innumerable horrible atrocities and human rights violations in every respect, from attacks on their villages, from the burning and destruction of their villages, to limitations on basic civil and political rights, such as organizing their own parties and their own journals. Anyone who speaks out with a pro-Kurdish tendency, even today in Turkey, is likely to be prosecuted and even imprisoned. However, that in no way can be a justification for abuses by the PKK. The PKK has committed summary executions in a very large number. It has attacked civilians, including Kurdish civilians that it believed were in working with the Turkish government. Now, we may on some level understand why they would do that, but international law prohibits that kind of attack on civilians. Humanitarian law prohibits that, not only by the government side, but by any other armed forces that are operating. And as a human rights organization, we understand on the one hand and have many times documented the abuses against Kurds, but that does not and cannot possibly justify humanitarian law violations by the other side. I think one of the things that we need to work on, and that Human Rights Watch will certainly be working on, is to take this opportunity to once again press the Turkish government, if they are really serious about justice, that justice should not only apply to Öcalan, it should apply to the Turkish armed forces. And we have said and will continue to work to pressure the Turkish government to bring its own security forces to justice. There needs to be a serious investigation in Turkey about the role that the Turkish security forces have played in the southeast and the numerous atrocities that have been committed by their side.
Vera Sayedpour, I wanted to get your response, but also in this last minute, to ask you about what you assess to be the total shakeup in a number of governments now. You have the Greek foreign minister and others who have been forced to quit in Greece. You have the Israeli consulate security in Berlin shooting dead three Kurds. You have a Kenyan government shakeup. This is having world implications.
Well, you know, I'm sure that it does. I was rather surprised that at the attacks on the protests in front of the Greek embassies, because I mean I'm sure that the Greeks were on the end of the diving board because they had Öcalan in their care. But I think that the Kurds realize that the relationship between Israel and Turkey, and Israel provides intelligence services, strategic intelligence services to Turkey, so that they they begin to see the antecedents to the situation. The United States also has been the greatest supporter of Turkey, and even in the reports that came out to date, the United States has said they were not, quotes, directly involved, and that's according to Reuters reports. So you see that that Turkey did not do this alone. And so the Kurds are simply reacting at this point because they're desperate because of the situation that, you know, that has emerged out of this Öcalan's going to Europe. I mean, you can't. This is a very, very volatile situation now. It's extremely volatile, and nobody knows which turn it can take. The intervening variables are many in this situation. I would also like to respond to something that the Human Rights Watch
Holly Kartner,
said,
and we just have 10 seconds, so very quickly.
I'm sorry. It's that the abuses of Kurds by Kurds, which Öcalan is being indicted partly for, has been going on in Iraqi Kurdistan since the Gulf War, and organizations like Human Rights Watch have not exposed that at all. So I find it interesting, that selective kind of indignation.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Vera Bodin Saidpour, founder of the Kurdish Library and the Kurdish Museum of New York, and editor of Kurdish Life and the International Journal of Kurdish Studies. Also, Holly Kartner, executive director of Human Rights Watch for Europe and Central Asia. We will certainly continue to follow on a daily basis the situation of the Kurds both throughout Europe and in Turkey itself. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The United States stepped up pressure today for a Kosovo peace deal by sending 51 extra military aircraft to Europe to prepare for possible NATO strikes on Yugoslav targets. Secretary of Defense William Cohen ordered the deployment of the stealth fighters and other aircraft to assure that NATO has the capability to conduct operations should that prove necessary. That, according to the Pentagon in a statement yesterday. A Saturday deadline has been set for a peace deal. NATO Secretary General Javier Solana warned today that NATO would act swiftly if Serbs and ethnic Albanians failed to reach a peace agreement at talks in France. Asked at a news conference in Macedonia how fast NATO would act if the talks failed, Solana said it would be very soon. And Russian President Boris Yeltsin said today he's told President Bill Clinton that Russia will not allow NATO to launch airstrikes against Yugoslavia over the Kosovo crisis. His comments toughened Russia's resistance to the use of force against its fellow Slavs in Yugoslavia, but Moscow's ability to prevent airstrikes is strictly limited. Joining us to talk about the situation of Serbia today are two guests. We're joined by Bogdan Denich, honorary chair of the Democratic Socialists of America. He also works at the Institute for the Transition to Democracy that operates in Serbia, Croatia, and Bosnia. Michel Colon is also with us. He's a journalist and writer for Solidaire, a weekly paper in Brussels. He's author of the book Beware of the Media, about Western media lies during the Gulf War and liar's poker, the great powers Yugoslavia and the next war. Bogdan Denich, let's begin with you, your assessment of where we are right now in Kosovo.
I think we're very close to a blockage of any development in Kosovo, and I'm afraid that bombing is a likely option. I happen to think it's a bad option, although I do think that the presence of troops is absolutely essential if any kind of treaty is to be worth the paper it's written on. I don't think the Albanians would accept any agreement which does not include a very substantial presence of troops, and I frankly think that the Belgrade regime's refusal of troops is fatal for the continued existence of the Serb minority in Kosovo. There's nothing except troops that can preserve their safety. I think there's they're beginning to be breaks within the Serbian community over that. And finally, I think that we make two basic mistakes, we meaning the United States and Western Europe and even Russia. One is we try to have the two negotiating groups be homogenous instead of encouraging differences within them. If there are going to be two homogenous communities, Albanians and Serbs, facing off with each other, there's not going to be any peace in Kosovo. There is no way that can continue. On the contrary, I think we should be backing the democratic opposition in Serbia. We've spent less on them than one rocket would cost. Certainly less than one plane would cost over the past 10 years. And we've really refused to back any except the kind of opposition made in Washington, namely nice people who speak English, who are liberal, who are pro-market, and who use deodorant. Those people are not, in my opinion, any alternative to Milosevic. The same thing with the Albanians. There have been social democratic parties there. There have been human rights organizations there. There are various non-government NGOs out there. We tend to say, if they're weak, we don't back them. And, of course, they're weak because we don't back them. We need plurality within both communities if they're going to live together, and geography dooms them. Lastly, no one has paid any attention to the fact that there are very strong voices within the Albanian community whose lives are now in danger from KLA. KLA is not just killing Serbs. Serbs are not just killing off Albanians. They're killing off their own dissidents. And major figures like Mahmoud Bakali, the former head of the communist organization in Kosovo, and Skechen Maliki, have been warning that independence could only create a squalid Bantustan, which would be a disaster for the Albanian majority. They're looking for other kinds of solutions, like perhaps a federalization of Yugoslavia. One also note of correction. They're not going to be airstrikes against Yugoslavia. If there are airstrikes, they're going to be against Serbia. No one proposes airstrikes against the other republic, which is Montenegro. And I think they're surely not stupid enough to hit Kosovo. So my question is, what can the airstrikes achieve? My scenario is something like Iraq right now. There'll be flights, there'll be strikes and so on. It'll strengthen the Milosevic regime and probably destroy the opposition.
Michel Colon, your take on this.
I think the problem is not like that. The problem is not to see what the great powers can do to bring peace in this area, because they are not there to bring peace or to protect any population. If you have a doubt, you must look at what United States is doing in Turkey, backing fascist general to massacre Kurdish people. You must see what the Western governments have been doing in Africa, doing nothing to prevent the genocide in Rwanda. On the contrary, assisting, informing, and arming those fascists in Rwanda, and now the same game in Congo. So they are never, never for any humanitarian purpose in any country in the world. So the question is, what are they doing there? My view and what I demonstrate in this book is that they are in Yugoslavia to break a resistance of an independent country to force that country to open the doors completely for multinationals and NATO. Just one important thing is that Yugoslavia is exactly the country that refuses to be part of the NATO. And that's why they are punished. So I think the great powers are not the solution to our problem. They are the problem themselves. And it's, I believe, for progressive people, it's very naive to think that those great powers might do some good job in Kosovo while they are attacking Iraqi people, while they are attacking Kurdish people, while they are supporting UNITA, who is a group of bandits in Africa. They have killed 700,000 people following the United Nations, and that's what the United States is now supporting them. Germany, France, Belgium is not doing better. So it's completely naive to wait for a solution for them. They are the problem. They are attacking every people who wants to resist: Iraq, Yugoslavia, Congo, Cuba, Korea, any. And so my idea is that what they want now is that they want to have military bases in the Balkans. It's obvious, since I exposed that in my book, since the 90s, United States have got many and many military bases there. It's not only for the problem of Kosovo. It's not at all for the problem of Kosovo. You should remind, in 97, there was a social upstanding from the people in Albania. They were fed up with this capitalism, everybody getting poor, and they were fed up and there was an upstanding. What have they done? The great Western powers have sent their troops led by Italy. And who was Italy? Italy was the investor number one in Albania. So they are there to protect the investment of the multinationals. They are there to break a country who resists to their system. And I think the problem is every progressive in every country should unite against those attacks. And I think that's the only solution.
Michel Colon, journalist and writer for Solidaire, a weekly paper in Brussels. His book is called Liar's Poker, The Great Powers, Yugoslavia, and the Next War. Bogdan Denich, you're the honorary chair of Democratic Socialists of America. Do you see that the Western powers could do anything productive in Kosovo? Do you agree or disagree with Michel Colon?
I disagree. I think that Western powers are analogous to racist cops in the United States. They're corrupt, they're racist, and they're wicked. But yet I don't hesitate to call them when I see murder done. I think it would be a disaster if the Western powers plus Russia, remember, plus Russia, pulled out of Bosnia today, would get right back to a war. They imposed a terrible peace, which was only slightly better, but was better, than a terrible war. And I think that at the present time, to talk about the resistance to globalization and world capitalism is a bad mistake, because it assumes that the enemy of my enemy is my ally. I speak as a leftist. No, the enemy of my enemy could be a totalitarian tyrant who is worse for his people than even the enemy that I mainly oppose. I am absolutely taken aback that anybody on the left would offend the right of the North Korean regime to continue starving its population in the name of resistance to globalization. Excuse me, I didn't interrupt you. Or the right of Milosevic's regime to keep massacring Albanians. There's been a 10-year repression of the Albanian population there. It has to be stopped. Now, I don't see how it can be stopped when the Milosevic regime, like the Tudjman regime in Croatia, rests on national chauvinist mobilization and rests on a constant pointing out the threat of the West. The bulk of the Serbian population right now is desperate to get to be in Europe. Desperate. Their living standard is now a quarter of what it was before Yugoslavia broke up, and it was broken up by Milosevic's nationalists insisting on having a slight plurality of the population impose their will on the rest of the population. It began in Kosovo. It has to end in Kosovo. Kosovo has a 90% Albanian majority. There is no justification for Kosovo to continue being ruled from Belgrade. The sovereignty of Serbs does not justify tyranny over the Albanians. And the fact that the West is not doing anything on the Kurds is absolutely true. That does not mean it should not do something in Kosovo. Also, it's simply not true that UNITA is now backed by the West. That's just no longer true. That's 5 years out of date. And it is no longer true, by the way, that that the question of the massacres in Africa is all that clear. It is true that they stood by. It is true that America was criminally negligent. But I was for intervention in Rwanda when the massacre started. And I thought, and I think that the non-intervention there was a criminal act. There are 500,000 people dead because there was no intervention. I'm sorry. That argument is for me no more justified than to have treated Hitler's massacre of the Jews in Europe as an internal question for Germany. I don't believe sovereignty justifies massacres. I don't believe sovereignty justifies a repression of minorities in a given country. I believe that rights are human, they're individual, and they are not. I'm not a legalistic lawyer. I don't think Yugoslavia has sovereignty over Kosovo on any legitimate basis, certainly not on the basis of the will of the population.
Michel Colon.
I think this is based on a lot of disinformation in the Western media, and I proved in my book that our information before and during the Gulf War was completely false and completely a campaign of propaganda. I proved the same about the information concerning Bosnia and the Yugoslavian war. I think it's the same. You should not accept what the West is saying about those regimes who resisted them. Now, they are, and I studied in my book what I'm calling the demonization, the making of the devil of an enemy. And there are some methods, always the same, based on lies and deforming the things. And I think progressive people should be very cautious about that official information. Second, I don't think that Western powers are bringing peace anywhere. Let's look, they are very busy with Palestina since 40 years. What have they brought? Just massacre.
I just want to stick with Bosnia for a minute here, because we only have a few minutes, and rather than going to world examples. What about the 45 ethnic Albanians that were found massacred in Kosovo? Do you think that's just Western media disinformation?
I will just stress this point. The truth, the Western truth, was proclaimed by William Walker. Who is he? He's the guy who made plots against the Salvadorian progress. Please let me continue. He's a guy used to lie. His past has proved it. And
he was the U.S. ambassador.
He was being accused of many. Participating in many crimes of the death squadrons and so on, excuse me for my English. And I think this question of Rajak, there was an investigation, but the official truth was proclaimed and they were accused. I have studied in my book the massacres of Sarajevo, 92 in the bakery, 94 in Markale, and 95 again in the market. And it was the same scenario. All Western medias directly said those are the Serbs. It was never presented massacres in Mostar, for example, between nationalists, Croatian nationalists and Muslim nationalists, only there. There where you had the CIA and the Secret Service of Izet Begovic present, and any element against this thesis was put on the side. And afterwards, you had David Owen, the European mediator, who said, we knew that this bombing was made by the Muslim forces of Izet Begovic, and we have done everything so that the public opinion would not know. He recognized it, but after the war, of course, when it's too late. So be very careful.
You're not saying that this latest massacre of the 45 ethnic Albanians didn't happen, but you're just saying that other massacres should also be emphasized.
It's not proved. Have you proved that they were civilians? They were not recognized by the people of the village. It is said now that they had gunpowder on their fingers, and it was a battle. It was a fighting. It was just said now that there is a real fighting between two armies there. I mean, such a battle brings dead on both sides. I have a few questions. Why they were never presenting the Serbian dead, the Serbian casualties? Why they do not accuse the KLA, who is murdering a lot of people? You don't see the bodies, you don't see this emotion, you don't see this campaign of propaganda. So be very cautious.
Bogdan Denich, and then we have to wrap up.
One, I don't base my information on official Western news. I base it on years of work in the field, and my field workers are in Kosovo and in Bosnia, and we have participated in the digging up of mass graves and mass killings. There's no question but that there were mass killings on all sides in Bosnia, and most were on the part of the Serbs. I don't justify the Croats and Bosnians. I don't. I think they're all nationalists, they're engaged in mass killings. The fact is absolutely stubborn. Kosovo is 90% Albanian. The only way Serbs can maintain their presence there is by terror and by continual terror. There has been no proposal to let the population there make their own decision. And the only differences that I know among the Albanians are, do they want to be a republic within Yugoslavia, like Montenegro, or do they want to be independent?
On that note, we have to wrap up, and I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Bogdan Denic, Honorary Chair of the Democratic Socialists of America, and Michel Colon, journalist with Solidaire in Brussels. His book is called Liar's Poker, The Great Powers, Yugoslavia, and the Next War. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Until the philosophy which all one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Well, everywhere is war. It's a war. The dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, and the rule of international morality will remain in but a fleeting illusion to be pursued, but never attained. Well, everywhere is war. It's a war.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This week, the Justice Department closed the books on a $1.6 billion reparation program for ethnic Japanese interned in U.S. camps during World War II. It will now settle with 181 ethnic Japanese from Latin America who suffered similar treatment. According to the Justice Department, the redress program made $20,000 payments to more than 82,000 Japanese Americans or their heirs. Tomorrow is also the 57th anniversary of President Franklin Roosevelt's signing of Executive Order 9066, which authorized the establishment of the Japanese internment camps here in the United States. And to mark this week, we are joined now by Marnie Mueller, who has just published a political novel called The Climate of the Country. And it is a book about the Japanese internment camps here. Marnie Mueller was actually the first Caucasian born in Tule Lake Japanese-American segregation camp in Northern California, where her father, a pacifist, and her mother, a teacher, were working. So, Marnie Mueller, is this novel autobiographical?
Yes. I would say it's autobiographical. It's told from the point of view of two Caucasians, a man and a woman, who are based on my parents. But what happens in fiction is that the story sort of dictates what happens to the characters, and the characters dictate what happens to the story. So it actually veers off quite a bit from who my parents really were. But it's loosely based on their experiences in the camp.
It's a powerful book about a very shameful time in American history. Can you talk about how the main characters, Denton and Esther, came to be at this camp, and who were the Japanese Americans who were interned there?
Well, Denton and Esther basically were young radicals on the West Coast who had worked in the WPA and the Farm Security Administration, as my parents did. And when the war broke out, Denton actually declares himself to be a conscientious objector. He's not called up yet, so he still has a choice of where he's going to, what he's going to do with his life. And because the Japanese Americans are interned in the camps, and he feels that this is an egregious injustice that's done to them, and feels that it's a horrible experience that he hopes he can make less horrible by going there to work. So he goes to work, and he's a man who knows how to set up cooperative stores. This is his, but that was sort of a young radical movement in the 30s and 40s. And then he gets a job at the camp, and he goes to work at the camp and sets up a camp-wide, democratically, consumer participatory organization actually behind prison walls, behind barbed wire. And that, of course, is the irony, and that's sort of the basis of the story, is how he works to resolve that that contradiction, I would say.
And tell us about the Japanese Americans that are at this camp.
At this particular camp? Well, first of all, they're, across the board, and all kinds of Japanese Americans. They're Japanese who are Issei, who are first generation who immigrated to the United States. Then there are the Nisei, who are the second generation, who are American citizens. And there are Kibei, who are actually Nisei, who were educated in Japan. They were sent back to Japan to be educated and then came back here. And that everyone was incarcerated in these camps, women, children, young men, old men. What happened was, after they'd been incarcerated for about a year, the government decided to recruit men out of the camp to fight in the war. And in order to do that, the government felt they had to show that they were loyal. I think they had to show the American population that they were not taking traitors out of the camps. So they instituted a loyalty questionnaire for people to sign to prove their loyalty. And there were two questions that were extremely important on that loyalty questionnaire. One was asking people to swear allegiance to the United States of America, and the other was asking them to forswear allegiance to the emperor and to Japan. And what that meant was that the Issei, the first generation, who were not allowed to be American citizens in the United States, didn't allow them to be, it meant that they would be a people without a country. And so they answered no to both of those questions. And what happened was, their children, who were citizens of the United States, many of them felt that they would be separated from their parents if they answered differently than their parents. So many of them answered no. And then there were many, such as the Kibei, who were more aligned with Japan, who answered no just out of rage that this should be done to them and to their parents. And then what happened was that the government decided they could not keep these people within the general population of the camps, so they segregated them.
The people who were called the no-nos.
The people who were called the no-nos, because they had said no to both of those loyalty questions. And so they moved them to Tule Lake and made that into a high-security camp. Now, what happened was, they moved a lot of people, the, quote, loyal people, out of Tule Lake, but many of the people did not want to leave there because that was now, they didn't want to be moved again. And so a great deal of friction grew up between these two groups within Tule Lake and led to violence. It's what's to be expected. When people are oppressed to a certain point, violence erupts, and that's the moment that the book starts.
Can you describe that? Because it's also a time of a major clampdown in the camp.
Yes. There's a moment when there's an insurrection in the camp, which is November 4th. It's a very famous night in the camp. And it really wasn't even that violent or anything. But the person who was the project director at that point really wanted to lean on the people who were giving him trouble. And what he did at that point was call the army in, and the army then took over the camp.
And this was November 4th, 1943.
I mean, people had been in the camp for quite a while by then, about a year and a half, actually.
And what did it mean for the military to move in?
It was pretty devastating for everyone. It was devastating for people who had tried to make a decent life within the camp, who had had these democratic organizations that they were working within. And it was used then by the more militant people in the camp as a sort of a rallying point. So it just kept heightening the problems. And Nobody's really at fault. I mean, I would say the project director is at fault for calling in the army, but within the population, when people began to turn against each other, nobody was really at fault, but that's what happens. I mean, we know that very well ourselves in our own country, in our own life now. I would say that I think of that as another country. That's so interesting. It isn't. It's America. But that's so often what happens. And that's what it meant. It meant to people. It was just devastating to people. People turned against each other. People ratted on each other. And it was very, very bad. And people lived with that shame for 50 years. It's a terrible thing.
In the news earlier this week was the story of people being compensated by the U.S. government. What was that about?
I think it started about 10 years ago. There were a group of people who spearheaded this movement, and there's one man, William Horry, who's actually a man I correspond with, who really pushed this issue to get the government to pay reclamations to Japanese Americans who had been incarcerated in the camps, who had been uprooted from their homes, sometimes at 24 hours' notice, and left all their belongings and lost everything. And it finally happened. Ironically, it happened with Reagan Bush, and it was determined that they would be paid $20,000 for this uprooting and for the incarceration, which, you know, doesn't even begin to cover.
For each individual?
For each individual, or for children, the people who had been in the camp who had since died, you know, direct descendants. And they gradually paid them out, and they just stopped paying them. And it said in the paper that 87,000 people had been paid. I think that was the figure. I'm not sure. But so that, you know, 120,000 people were incarcerated, but that at least 87,000 had been paid.
We're talking to Marnie Mueller. She's the author of a new book, The Climate of the Country, which is about the Japanese American internment camps in World War II, just after the bombing of Pearl Harbor by the Japanese. You have a character in your book named Nibomota.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little about him.
Nibomota is a Kibe. He's the one I described him before. He had been sent back to Japan to be educated. And he's, on one hand, a very valiant character. He believes very strongly that it was a racist internment. He gradually comes to that after the loyalty oaths. He was quite cooperative until that point, that turning point, when the loyalty oaths were instituted. And he had great leadership qualities. He has great leadership qualities. And he then began to use the leadership qualities in a more militant mode. And he, you know, stands up against the more moderate people within the camp. And he starts a movement within the camp to put pressure on the administration. And he gathers people around him. And, you know, it's what happens often with a radical movement, that it begins to turn in upon itself and sometimes hurts more people along the way. And that's really what I try to show, that can happen, although people often ask me about that character, and I love that character. I mean, there's a great deal of me in that character. But I also know what happens when the balance gets tipped over. And it's sort of a cautionary tale in a way, or at least to make people – that's a question that I'm constantly asking in the book, whether, you know, it's violence versus pacifism versus negotiation. It's not a question that I really have, even by the end of the book, have an answer to. But sadness comes out, bad things come out of his movement, but not even so much because of him, but also because of the pressure that's put on by the administration and by the army being in there.
How did these camps ultimately get disbanded?
Well, they gradually were getting disbanded not long after they even were set up. Many young students got to get out to go to college, or if someone could find a job on the outside. I found lots of my father's memos and letters and things, and in those letters I found him writing letters, very passionate letters about racism and everything, to people outside of the camp, trying to get jobs for the people in the camp to get them out. So a number of people got out that way gradually over time. And then little by little, they did disband the camps. Tule Lake was the last camp to be disbanded. But the others, I mean, they began to really be disbanded 44, 45, and then finally 46. Everybody was out. But what happened was many of the older people, the Issei, were terrified then to leave the camps because of the racism on the outside, because of the racism that they had experienced being put into the camps. So sometimes it was a little hard to move people out. And understandably, they were very frightened. And then there was the question of where would you move would you move back to the West Coast? And for quite a while, you couldn't move back to the West Coast because the order of exclusion had not been rescinded. So that meant going to Chicago or someplace, which was a completely new place, but and particularly for farming people, and it was very, very complicated. So there was yet another relocation of people after the camps were disbanded.
How did you do the research for your novel?
Well, I talked to my father. I interviewed him before he died and got lots of stuff from him. I interviewed actually some Japanese-American people that he had worked with in the camps. And then I read a lot. I just read, there are lots of nonfiction books. So I sort of, I didn't read fiction books because I didn't want to, steal from the fiction books for my novel. But and in one day when I was reading one of the fiction books, there was a voice of a Nisei giving an answer that was not a usual answer within the camps.
This is one of the nonfiction books?
It's one of the nonfiction books. And he was giving an answer that was very angry, and that was not usually what happened contemporaneously. The anger was not expressed to a staff member. And I looked at the footnote, and it said, this blah, blah, blah was speaking to Don Elberson, and Don Elberson was my father. And I thought, so I called the author, and he said, yes, Don Elberson shows up in all of my research. And he sent me to the National Archives and to Bancroft Library. And in the National Archives, they rolled out 18 boxes of my father's papers, which was very powerful. And then when I got to Bancroft, I found the best stuff. I had heard that there were diaries written by Nisei intellectuals in the camps that covered everything, personal material, political material. And I asked for those diaries, and they brought them out, and there were huge stacks, and I thought, where am I going to start? And I just sort of opened at random, and about two pages later, a Nisei informant was saying, Don Elberson is the one Caucasian in the camp that we can trust. And from there, it was third-person narrative by this Nisei intellectual. And he would go into meetings, and then he would do the dialogue from the meetings, and there would be my father. Mm-hmm. And he sounded exactly like my father. And then they would go to dinner at my parents' house and say what my mother was cooking. She'd cook damn chicken and cherry pie or something like that. And then one guy actually even came in when I was being potty trained and described that. And it's marvelous. I mean, you're sitting there in a room of scholars reading about yourself being potty trained. But, no, I make light of it. But it was very, very, very powerful. And the only problem for me was that the character of Denton that I had developed was a pretty dark, conflicted, angry character. And I had done that purposely because I adored my father. And I thought, I cannot tell the story of, like this goody-goody, So I was, I'm pretty proud that I'd created this character. And then I go in there, and he's the goody-goody, in the documentation. So that actually threw me off for a long time. I mean, it was very hard then to feel I wasn't betraying his legacy and everything. And finally, I just said, look, I'm writing this book, and I have a right to write it in the way I write it.
Did he ever get to read it?
No. He didn't even know that this stuff was in Bancroft. He had no idea. He died long before I found the National Archives or the Bancroft stuff, so he had no idea. My mother knew that I had found the National Archives stuff, but she died before I found the Bancroft, so it's sad.
And Bancroft is?
It's the Bancroft. It's the real oral history library. It's a fabulous library at Berkeley. It's at the University of Berkeley.
Mm. Do you have any direct recollection of this time, or are you just too young?
I believe I have emotional memory because I don't. It's all pre-verbal memory, but that's. I look at two-year-olds. They really suck stuff in. Because what happened was when I first began to do research on this, it must have been 10 or 15 years ago, and I opened Mickey Wegland's book, which was almost the only book at that point that was written. It's Years of Infamy. It's sort of the seminal book still on the camps. And there was a picture of Tule Lake, and I just burst out crying. And I think, and as I read about it and read about the riot, because I know that I had really, something had happened to me during that period on November 4th. And I think I must have really read, I must have remembered it, emotionally.
Marnie Mueller has been our guest. She's the author of The Climate of the Country, a political novel about the Japanese-American segregation camps, internment camps of World War II. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and that brings us to the end of our show. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Special thanks today to Robert Knight. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!